There will be jobs for humans until we get to this tipping point, and I suspect it will be like a phase change. I think that we won't see it coming, and then it will be very quick, because machines will get over that hump, which means they can do just about everything that we can do for money.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is AI and the economic singularity. Will robots take all our jobs? With ChatGPT and GPT-4 and GPT-5 being the latest well-known applications in AI, the question on everybody's lips is, what does this mean for writers, academics, and many jobs? So this episode is going to ponder the question, when AI is doing many of our current jobs, what will humans be left with? My guest today is Callum Chase, who is the best-selling author of several books on AI, including Surviving AI, The Promise and the Peril of Artificial Intelligence, and The Economic Singularity. And he's going to discuss some of these concepts with us today. Welcome, Callum. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Andrew. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with you telling me a little bit about your background and what led you to writing on these topics.
Well, I blame science fiction, which I started reading as a young kid. And I had a hunch that philosophy was science fiction without the fancy dress. So when I went to college, I studied philosophy at Oxford, and I was right. That's exactly what science fiction is. So I have always been interested in the idea that one day we'd have immensely powerful artificial intelligences and they would be produce incredible impacts on all of us. But I didn't think that I would live to see it. I thought it would be thousands of years into the future. And my careers were originally in journalism and then in business. I was in sales and marketing, and then I was a strategy consultant for a couple of decades. And then I was CEO of a green tech startup. And I retired in 2011, and I don't play golf, so I needed something else to do. So I started reading more about artificial intelligence, and I started writing about it. I was very impressed by a book which I read in 1999, so considerably before I retired, by a man called Ray Kurzweil, who wrote, he's written a series of books, and the one I read was The Age of Spiritual Machines. And Kurzweil has, for a very long time, been saying that the exponential growth in the power of computers, which we call Moore's Law, will lead to us having machines which are as smart as an adult human. They have all the cognitive abilities of an adult human. And he has long predicted that that would happen in 2029. And then he thinks that we will merge with these machines somewhere in the rest of the century. And I thought that was a startling idea. I thought the argument about exponential growth of computing, the impact would have, I hadn't come across it before, and I was really struck by it. I was also very struck by his relentless optimism. I mean, he seemed to admit of no possibility of any downside in all this, and that struck me as being quite unwise, because it struck me that there was some very serious possible downside. So I did what any sensible person should do in encountering that idea. I thought I'd better write a book about it in order to get a movie made. Because I don't know any movie makers. So I thought I'd write a novel and then somebody will turn that into a film and then the world will wake up and take this seriously and we'll make sure it all goes in a good direction rather than a bad direction. So I wrote a novel the first time in 2000. I've no idea how I did that. I was in a very busy career. I had a young child, but somehow I managed to dash it off. And it was terrible. It was a truly awful book. I rewrote it after I retired, and I like to think that it's no longer terrible. I think it's quite a good book. It's called Pandora's Brain. So it's a novel about the arrival of the first superintelligence on the Earth. And what a lot of people said to me was, that's a good book, but it's two books. It's a novel, and it's a series of lectures about what AI is and where it's going. And you should separate them. You should split them out. So I did, and it became Surviving AI, which is about the technological singularity, which is when we get superintelligence. And then I went on to write The Economic Singularity, which is about something which may happen sooner, which you've referred to. It's the possibility of technological unemployment.
Yes, I mean, that is certainly something that there's a lot of chatter about at the moment. And I remember reading a statistic that 800 million jobs would be replaced with AI. And I remember also reading Kai-Fu Lee, who's an AI investor and the ex, you know, top chief executive of Google in China, predicting that in the next 15 years, we'd have about 40% of the world's jobs will be lost to automation. What do you think about those predictions?
Well, making specific predictions, I think, is possibly a worthwhile exercise. But the one thing we know about that sort of prediction is they're certainly going to be wrong, and probably very wrong. Mm. I think two broad things can be said. One is, if machines continue to get more and more powerful, and you know they haven't stopped, and there's no reason why they will stop in the near or medium term, then eventually they will become so capable that they'll be able to do everything that we can do for money, or pretty much everything we can do for money. At which point, because machines, you know, when they do a job, they generally do it quicker, faster, and cheaper than we do. There obviously will be no jobs for humans, so we'll need a different type of economy. But I think we're quite a long way from that. I don't think that moment is going to happen yet. What's going to happen in the meantime, and it's going to accelerate, is there's going to be more churn in the job market as machines take a job, and then the human who had that job is going to have to retrain and either get a new job within that company or join a new company or move to a new industry. And I think that churn is going to accelerate, and we need to get much, much better at giving people a safety net when they are in the process of transitioning and training them for a new job.
I found the chapter in your Economic Singularity book about the self-driving cars being the canary in the coal mine a very interesting chapter, because you mentioned, I think the figure was something like 40 million driving jobs that will be lost, but you also extended that, because that was all very interesting. I hadn't considered the concept around government revenue will be lost, because if it's a self-driving car, then it will be driving at the speed limit. It will be parking in legal parking spots. So there's going to be a lot of revenue loss from, you know, parking loss, speeding fines, etc. Can you discuss that a little bit more?
Well, there'll be all sorts of unintended consequences, but it's worth starting with the intended consequences, not least the fact that humans, we give ourselves a bad rap, call ourselves bad drivers, but we're actually not. You know, I've been driving for more years than I care to think, and I'm actually often very surprised as I drive down a two-lane highway and none of the cars in the opposite lane veer off and come and hit me. I always think that's really quite remarkable that has so rarely happened. In fact, it's never happened to me. So humans are actually quite good drivers. However, we do get tired, drunk, angry. We sometimes do naughty things like looking at our phones while we're driving, and we do cause accidents, and we kill 1.35 million people around the world every year. In many countries, if you are between, I think it's 12 and 24, then road accidents are the primary cause of death. So that's one of the intended consequences. Another one is the sheer boredom of commute driving, just sort of crawling along, looking at the number plate ahead of you. It's deathly dull, and it'd be great to liberate people from that. But yeah, there will be lots of unintended consequences, including pretty rapid unemployment for anybody driving a taxi or a bus, and the loss of revenue to all sorts of industries. You know, cars, not partly because they're self-driving and also partly because they'll be electric, cars will be much cheaper to run and take less, require less maintenance. So there's various industries that will suffer from that. There should be virtually no accidents, so the car insurance industry is going to disappear. Those people are going to have to find something else to do. And it might be that commuting, for those who, you know, need to commute at all, it might be that commuting distances expand, because now driving is generally a bit painful for commuters. But if you can just hop in your car, tell it where to go, and then sit back and watch a movie or read a book or do your emails, then maybe people will be willing to communicate, to commute much longer distances. And I have a lovely vision, which will probably never come to pass, but I have this lovely idea that many people will have RVs, motorhomes, as they're called in Europe, and they will be a part of their house. So you'll drive this RV into your house and it will be your living room or your bedroom or something. Mm-hmm. And then when you want to go somewhere, you reverse it out of your house and you dial in your destination and you go to sleep and you wake up in the destination.
That's pretty cool.
If you and your mates might virtually play spin the bottle and all decide, okay, we'll meet in Venice in 2 days' time. So you hop into your RVs and type in Venice and go to sleep and you wake up in Venice. I think that'd be rather nice.
Yeah, I quite like that idea as well, because it is that whole travel thing is just such a hassle. So it's a really interesting area. And I was thinking about the insurance aspect, but you've actually made me think about it slightly differently. I was thinking, if the manufacturers are making the car, then obviously it's not the human buyers of the car that would have insurance. It's got to be the manufacturers. But actually, there probably won't be a need for insurance in many ways. You're right, because if there's no accidents, because everything's all so regimented with AI and the cars are doing what they're meant to be doing. Yeah, very interesting. So what about other kinds of jobs? So these are more, jobs that are fairly easy to automate, but we're also seeing in, before I even get to that, the other thing I was just thinking about is industries changing is a very interesting topic, because insurance is one. But in my industry, I'm in pharmaceuticals, I can see so many changes that are going to be needed because we are having much faster diagnostics. So, there's a company I interviewed a few months ago, Grail, that have a single blood draw and they can predict in healthy people over 50 types of cancers. So, they get treatment before it becomes something serious. And so in lots of areas, we've got smart homes. One of my friends is an architect that builds in London homes that have AI in the mirrors and in the toilets. And so the bathroom mirrors can detect micro changes in the face and body that are indicative of illness. The toilet does urine and feces analyses every day. Now, they're very expensive homes right now, but that will come down, of course. So, in our watches, in all sorts of areas, we've got this diagnostics all around us. So the drug industry, pharmaceutical industry, that we're not going to need drugs for chronic conditions and also other conditions before they become chronic, because, much of pharma is oncology and diabetes are the two biggest areas. So the pharma industry is also going to have to change their business model. So I think that there's a lot of industries that are going to have to change their business model. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, healthcare is an enormous subject for AI and other fast-changing technologies. And there's a bunch of ways in which it's all going to change. One, as you say, is we're going to be gathering much better, much quicker, more comprehensive information about our health. With all the various devices that we wear, and as you say, toilets and mirrors. Somebody said recently the best places to gather information about your health are the ear and the rear. So your AirPods and your toilet might be your best friends. So there's that. And the next thing is that partly because of this amazingly richer source of information, we will have enough data, enough information that we can personalize medicines. We can have drugs which are tailored to individual people. And that may well be the thing that makes healthcare instead of sick care, because at the moment, in most countries, the medical industry pays you no attention whatsoever until you're sick.
Exactly.
And it'd be a much better idea if it stopped you getting sick, because then you'd stay healthy longer and also you'd cost a lot less.
Exactly.
And the drug industry is also going to change enormously because of AI. Companies like InSilico and Exscientia are using AI to develop drugs. And it turns out that they can do it much cheaper and much faster. And I find this really interesting. So InSilico says it costs them about 2 or 3 million and a couple of years, very broad brush, to develop a new drug. They've got one for IFP, which I'll get wrong, but it's something like idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, IPF. Mm-hmm. There you go. Whereas using the traditional pharmaceutical process would have taken 10 years and cost billions.
Yeah.
So the interesting question to me is, how come the rest of the pharmaceutical industry still exists? Why haven't they all immediately change to this new way of doing things. And of course, the devil is always in the detail with these things. I'm sure it's not as simple as that. I'm sure there's tons of reasons why it can't happen overnight. But some of it is probably organizational lethargy. People are used to doing things in a particular way. Massive infrastructures have grown up to make things happen in a certain way. And it's tough to change those large industries overnight. But, you know, I guess that will happen. So the healthcare industry is going to change beyond recognition.
Exactly.
Which is terrific. And of course, the really big one, which almost nobody is talking about, is that it's not impossible that we will defeat aging fairly soon. And by fairly soon, I mean within maybe 10, maybe 20 years.
Because there's a lot of the diseases very good research.
The diseases you mentioned, you know, cancer, heart attack and heart disease and dementia, they're essentially results of aging. And we kind of know what aging is. We haven't got a complete theory of it. And there's the detail is enormously complicated. But with very, very powerful machines, we may well be able to stop aging in the next decade or two. And that means that people may stop dying. Now, personally, I'm 64. How old am I? Yeah, 64. And so it can't come a moment too soon for me. But, you know, for everybody who's got parents and grandparents and who would like to live, you know, a few hundred years or 1,000 years, that should be tremendously good news. But nobody is thinking about this. That's one of these other things that just never ceases to amaze me.
Well, there actually are quite a few startups that are very focused on AI and longevity. And I have met a few that have got some very interesting research that's going on in that space. That is something. I think your point about pharma, it is a constant frustration for me, I can assure you. I talk about it all the time. But some of them are starting to change. So, for example, AstraZeneca is working with, I think it's Benevolent AI. And so they've got compounds that they're doing much faster in the R&D phase, although the challenge we always have, but I think that also will change, is we have to have the clinical trials to get through approval, and that does take years to get the patients, etc. But even that, I can see a complete overhaul in the coming decades, because have you heard of digital twins? So I think we will all have a digital twin. You know, we've already got digital twins of hearts and pancreas and parts. I was talking to someone yesterday from an AI company who's doing it with the brain. So there's eventually, not there yet, but eventually we will all have a digital twin. So when that time comes, all drugs can be, you know, like we do we used to have crash test cars. Now it's all done mathematically. I think clinical trials will all be done mathematically with digital twins in the future, and that will speed things up. I think some of them are taking on board that, you know, discovery part, but then they still have that laborious years of clinical trials, which is frustrating. The only time we've ever really avoided that was COVID, because it was a need. You know, the government let things go through, but unfortunately for many, it can't. But there will be things that AI does to speed that up, which will be really interesting. One of the interesting points that you mention in your book is that you said within a few decades, most humans will not be able to work for money and all jobs will be affected. And it is true that already we're seeing, you know, AI performing better in customer service and IT support desk engineers, but we're also seeing it superior at medical, you know, will a tumor progress? You know, the AI gets it right more than the doctor does, the oncologists do. Or, you know, is this lung scan mean COVID or mean whatever? The AI gets it in 20 seconds. Also legal, you know, there's that AI robot, AI lawyer, robo lawyer, I think he's called in the US, who wins every legal case. So technology does, of course, always replace jobs, but new jobs are often created. However, I'd like to see your thoughts on new versus none in the coming decades for humans.
Well, to sum it up, I think it's none at some point in the future. And I used to think it was 25 years or so away. Now I think it might be sooner than that.
Interesting.
ChatGPT and GPT-4 have caused me, along with many other people who think about AI a lot, to revise our timelines downward. I used to think it was 25 years away. It is still not here yet. And you're right. Automation has replaced jobs since the Elizabethan age, if not before.
Yeah.
And the huge example of it is the agricultural industry, which used to employ almost everybody. And even as recently as 1800s, it employed 80% of American workers. Now agriculture employs 1% of American workers. And all those people who used to work on farms have got other jobs, otherwise we would all be unemployed. And actually their jobs are safer and more interesting and better paid, because all those descendants of farmers are working in shops and offices and busy talking to each other on podcasts. So automation takes a job, but it also creates wealth, and wealth creates demand, and demand creates new jobs. So as long as there are some things that machines can't do, and it might all be plumbing, you know, we might all end up as plumbers until they finally get a machine to be able to do plumbing. That's a joke, by the way. It's not going to be like that.
It could be
possibly. Yeah. Yeah, so we'll all be standing there going, "Whoa, you shouldn't have had somebody do that." There will be jobs for humans until we get to this tipping point. And I suspect it will be like a phase change, like when you boil water. You put a lot of heat into water and nothing happens. And then suddenly bubbles start forming and it's become steam. And I think that massive widespread technological unemployment will be like that. We won't see it coming, and then it will be very quick, because machines will get over that hump, which means they can do just about everything that we can do for money. So in the short term, we need to be getting much better at helping people transition between jobs, because that's going to become more and more frequent. But we also need to be planning for the arrival of what I call the economic singularity, which is just a slightly quicker way of saying technological unemployment. Mm-hmm. Because we don't know what that economy could look like. It's an economy in which humans don't do jobs, because machines do all the jobs, which at one level should be absolutely wonderful, because for most people, probably not most of the people who talk to each other on podcasts, but for most people, jobs are just something you do to put food on the table. They're not really, they don't give you much meaning. And most people are very happy to retire from them, as you can see in France, where most of the country seems to be rioting about the idea of having to work to 64 instead of 62. So it should be great if machines do all the jobs and humans can do whatever we want. You know, we can be, we can practice our golf or write books about AI or watch movies and talk to each other and explore and learn languages. And I don't think that will mean everybody gets bored or resorts to drink and drugs, because that's not what happens to most people on holiday. We're pretty good as a species at finding things to entertain ourselves with, and indeed to find worthwhile projects to entertain ourselves with. Mm-hmm. But the issue is, and it's funny, because most people, when you talk to them about a post-jobs world, that's the thing they worry about. They think, well, what will we do with ourselves? Well, I don't worry about that. I'm sure we'll find lots of worthwhile things to do. Yeah. But what I do worry about is how we're all going to get money you know, access to the resources that you need. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's an answer. I think it's the economy of abundance, which is quite a big idea and takes a bit of explaining. But it's, broadly speaking, the idea that the cost of all the goods and services you need for a very, very good standard of living drop close to zero, which is possible, I think, due to the efficiency of AI, due to very cheap energy from renewables, and due to taking humans out of the workplace, because it's humans that are generally the most expensive part of any production process. So I think abundance is kind of the answer, but how we get from here to there, and who owns what, and how the resources get distributed, we haven't begun to think about that, and we should do, especially if the arrival of GPT-4, whether it's correct for people to be down revising their timeline, so it actually could arrive in, you know, 10 to 15 years.
Yeah. What do you think are the risks we as humanity face in this situation?
Well, AI is a technology, and any technology can have good outcomes or bad outcomes. Humanity's first technology was fire. We learned how to tame fire, and that was really the first revolution in human history, because it enabled us to ingest energy much more efficiently and grow brains. It also enabled us to stop living in trees because we could keep predators away at night without having to climb up trees, and that turns out to have been quite useful. But so fire can keep you warm and it can cook your food, but it can also burn you. So, you know, right, as far back as then, we've known that technology is a double-edged sword. And AI is our most powerful technology, or is becoming our most powerful technology. And so the upsides are absolutely stupendous. I mean, really, as Sam Altman, the founder of OAI, which OpenAI, which released ChatGPT and GPT-4, said when he went to Congress, he said, when you start talking about the upsides from AI, from really advanced AI, you sound like a crazy person. Fortunately, I don't too much mind sounding like a crazy person. I kind of get paid to do it, so it's okay. But there are major, major downsides. And the downsides fall into two buckets. There's the short-term downsides, including privacy, bias, lack of transparency, the debatable claim that AI is making us all polarized and populist, and the debatable claims that it is going to be able to target us all with scams much, much more efficiently. And so we'll all be sending money to Nigerian princes that we didn't mean to. But there are real issues in the short term. And a lot of people call that AI ethics, which I personally think is a bad name because it means that anybody who disagrees with you is a bad person. And I think that's very unhelpful. I like to call it responsible AI. Mm-hmm. But then there's the longer term issues of which are known as alignment or AI safety, AI alignment or AI safety, which are thinking about what happens when we have machines which are smarter than us. Mm. At the moment, humans are the smartest animals or the smartest entities on the planet, and the second smartest entity is a chimpanzee. There's about 500,000 chimpanzees on the planet, and there's 8 billion of us. And those 500,000 chimpanzees, they survive entirely because we choose to let them survive. They have no say in their future whatsoever, and they have the good fortune that they don't know that. When there's an entity much smarter than us on the planet, which may happen in, I mean, some people think it could happen as soon as 5 years' time, but certainly I would think by the end of the century, we'll be in the same position as the chimpanzees, except that we will know about it. And so those concerns, and I think they are real concerns, and I don't think people should poo-poo them, those are called AI alignment and AI safety concerns.
Mm. I mean, I do remember at least a decade ago, Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates all talking about that and saying, you know, the most likely way that humans will become extinct is through AI. So it's very interesting. I mean, at the moment, the majority of what we've got, as far as I'm aware, I know there's some discussion of AGI, but most of it's ANI, you know, artificial neural intelligence. To create this economic singularity, we're going to have to get to AGI. How close do you think we are? Do you think it is about 15 years?
Well, that's not quite right. The arrival of the economic singularity doesn't require artificial general intelligence. It just requires machines
to do everything.
Artificial general intelligence. Yeah, exactly. Artificial general intelligence is a machine with all the cognitive abilities of an adult human. And it probably won't be around for very long because it will quickly turn into a super intelligence, which is a machine which is smarter than humans.
Way smarter.
And it will probably... quickly, and there's a lot of debate about whether this will be quick or slow, but I personally think it would be quick, probably become a machine which is much smarter. You don't need that to get to the stage where machines can do pretty much everything. They can do for money, because, you know, we when we go to work, people often say, bring your whole self to work. Well, we generally don't. You know, most of us, when we're working, we're not deploying every single aspect of ourselves. We're doing it. We're doing a task, and so you don't need AGI. So timelines, I used to think that it was probably, and this is, I say this with enormous lack of confidence. You know, the timing is really hard to predict, as the order in which jobs will disappear is enormously hard to predict. But it seems silly to be a futurist and not be willing to give some sort of predictions. I used to think it was 25 years thereabouts to the economic singularity and 50 years to the technological singularity and superintelligence. And I'm thinking now maybe we should halve those timelines. So 12 years, a dozen years to the economic singularity, and then another dozen to the technological.
Wow, that's really quick. But it is true, everything's coming so fast now. And the developments, like I've been looking at generative AI for making videos, because I'm actually giving a talk to all the CEOs of a pharma company, the country CEOs, and they wanted a video on the future. And so I thought, well, why don't I use generative AI to create this video on the future? And so I've been testing a lot. And there's one that's actually about, it's not released yet, but I've been looking at the pre-release, what it does. And it's incredible. I mean, you can actually just write a script and it creates the whole video. So it is amazing, all the stuff, even the creative kind of things. You know, you can get ChatGPT to write the script and this generative AI to make the movie. So it is really interesting. Yeah. What about what you said before about the positive aspects and sounding like a madman? Let's let you explore the sounding like a madman part. What are the positive aspects you see developing out of this?
Good. Well, I'm glad you've done that rather than focusing entirely on the downside. I think in the very short term, I think people are going to find their work life speeds up a lot thanks to GPT-4. I think an awful lot of people who are knowledge workers will find that they can get the first draft of their consultant report. They can get the first iteration of the spreadsheet and the charts if they're analysts. They can get all that to happen in moments rather than in hours. And I think that's going to be actually great fun for anybody who chooses to engage with it. And if I have one piece of advice for anybody listening to this is get your hands on GPT-4 and play with it. Do it a lot. Mm-hmm. Get to know how it works, what it can do, because it's very likely to be essential to your job. The cliche is that AI won't take your job yet, but somebody who can work with AI will. So that's the very short term. Then in the sort of medium term of the economic singularity, I foresee a possible world, if we're smart and a bit lucky, where, as I say, humans are liberated from being wage slaves. We don't have to do jobs anymore. And we can do whatever we want. And we have a really good standard of living at virtually no cost. Not quite sure how it gets paid for. We need to figure out the details of that. Mm-hmm. That's a big question. We do need to start thinking about that. But that would be an enormous shift for the better in human life. And possibly around about the same time as that, we stop dying, or at least we stop aging, and that stops most deaths, which would also be really an extraordinarily wonderful thing. Then in the longer term, when we get superintelligence, let's assume we have a superintelligence a million times smarter than Albert Einstein, and it really likes humans. It thinks humans are the bee's knees.
That would be a nice nice side of it. One option, yeah.
A nice outcome, yeah. So it thinks, wow, you people created me. I love you for that. You're also 8 billion really interesting, varied, ingenious little monkeys. And I find you endlessly entertaining. I mean, admittedly, you only take up about a half of my bandwidth or a quarter of my bandwidth, and that's a shrinking part as I continue to expand my computronium mind, but still, you know, you're fascinating. So I'd like to keep you alive. I'd like to keep you happy and thriving. And in fact, the best thing to do would be, well, why don't you come and join me? Why don't you come and join me in a sort of uploaded virtual life inside my brain? And we all, or like a lot of us say, yeah, that sounds great fun. And I'll be at the head of that queue. And we live extraordinary, unlimited lives inside this weird virtual world. And a few people say, ugh, that's nasty. I want to stay human. So the superintelligence says, that's absolutely fine. I mean, do you mind if I stop you aging? Do you mind if I make sure you never feel any discomfort? Is that okay? Do you mind if I do that? And they go, oh, all right then. And so you have some people who are atomists who want to stay human, but most people upload into the superintelligence and we all whiz off and explore the universe together.
Live in the Matrix.
See, I told you it was crazy.
No, well, actually,
not the Matrix. The Matrix is a dystopia.
I'd love that movie. But yeah, one thing that you've made me think about is actually that's not that crazy, because we already have something I presented at a conference about 13 years ago was, you know, the future patient of ours, because I'm in pharma. And, you know, we'll have neural implants and we'll have this and we'll have that. And I looked at that slide recently for something. And I thought, oh, my God, every single thing on this slide that, you know, 13 years ago was just fantasy, it actually exists. And there's one guy I was talking to who's got – he's had a neural chip for 5 years now in his brain, which he's paralyzed, but it allows him to think about particular things and interact with computers and wheelchairs and things with his mind. So we're already – and, of course, there's, you know – Elon Musk's neural chip company as well. There's a lot of neural chips going on. So that's kind of partially emerging, and you can kind of get to the next thought, which is we could all have a neural chip and we can download whatever information on whatever topic, just like a digital human can now, and learn. I want to speak Spanish. Let me download the Spanish chip. You know, you could actually emerge
like
in that way.
Like in the like in the Matrix, I know
exactly.
I think we shouldn't run away with thinking that we've done this little step and therefore that means we can do that slightly bigger thing, because you know there are 86 billion neurons in our brains, and mm-hmm. each of them is wired to 10,000 other neurons on average, and trying to connect that organ with a computer is a mind-bogglingly huge task. That's one I think we will address and tackle at some point, but we'll need much, much more powerful machines than we have today. Whereas the task of getting somebody to be able to communicate to a computer, move this seat forward or roll that wheel or whatever, using the plasticity of neurons, you don't need to connect very many neurons to the machine to do that. It's an enormous step to be able to, I don't know, to communicate telepathically through the machine, and certainly a massive, massive step to be able to upload. I do think we'll get there, and maybe hopefully even in my lifetime, but it's a fair ways off.
I agree, it is a fair way off. I know all the trials that Neuralink have had in, you know, they need, I think they started, I can't remember how many electrodes, and I think they got to 1,000, but they need many thousand to really, you know, make it really impactful. So it will take time, it's improving and improving. When they started, they had like less than 100. So it is improving, but as you say, it will take time. Yeah, definitely.
And of course, Elon Musk started Neuralink in order to address the issue, the AI alignment issue, because he thought that, and I think he's right, that merging with machines is our best future once superintelligence arrives. And so he thought, well, the sooner we have the technology available to do that, the better. So he then decided that he was going to try and climb that mountain as well as all the various other mountains that he's climbing.
Yes. So, actually, did you ever see that movie Lucy with Scarlett Johansson?
Yeah.
So she merged with all the supercomputers as well. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's a good movie called Transcendence, which covers that idea as well. I like that movie.
Oh, I haven't seen that one or heard of it. I'll have to look that up.
It's got Johnny Depp as an AI professor who gets shot and then gets uploaded. Which is a fairly similar plot to the plot of my book, Pandora's Brain. My book's better, of course, but for some odd reason, nobody's made a movie of it yet.
Well, maybe after they hear about it now, we'll get some funding for it. Well,
yeah, if Ridley Scott's among your listeners, Ridley, that book is available.
I'll put a little tweet out for you. Thank you so much. This has been amazing. A really, really interesting discussion. For anyone listening who wants to read more about this, there's so much more in Callum's book, The Economic Singularity. So it's Callum Chase, The Economic Singularity, which you can find on Amazon. Thank you so much for your time today. I just found it fascinating, and I think I'll have to get you back to talk about your other book soon.
I'd like to do that. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been great fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.